Blog Talk Radio.
Best-selling and award-winning author of true crime and crime fiction, Yvonne Mason is back with a brand new book, The Pink Canary, a book that delves into the life of a drag queen and a marvelous whodunit. You can find this and all of Yvonne's other works on Amazon.com or find Yvonne Mason on Facebook and Twitter.
You're gonna kill me.
Buy your copy of Pink Canary now.
Well, good evening, ladies and gentlemen. Yes, it is Saturday night. This is Yvonne Mason, and this is Off the Chain, and that was a piece of shameless promotion. Y'all know I do that. That was my ad man, Chris Dunham, and he does all of my voiceover work for my books. And if you really like a hilarious murder mystery set in Key West, which is one of my favorite cities, and you enjoy drag queens, get this book because you will laugh yourself silly. In fact, I highly recommend that you go potty before you read the book because it a friend of mine said that it was Birdcage meets Ted Bundy. So put that in your mind and visualize it. Once again, ladies and gentlemen, this show, I am daily amazed, honored, and humbled at the response from you listeners because y'all are part of what makes this show successful. Ladies and gentlemen, we are like 4 listeners away from 8,000 listeners just on this show. This show's not even a year old. It will not be a year old until July the 27th. Overall, we're well over 20,000. I couldn't get a firm number because one of my podcasts wouldn't come up this morning to get the number, but we are well over 20,000 listeners. So in 64-plus countries, in little places like I've never even heard of, they're listening to this show. The other part of the equation that makes this show so wonderfully successful is my guest. And the reason for that is when I bring a guest on, I don't bring them on just once. I bring them back because you as the audience get, you want to know more about them, especially when they have new work coming out or up what they're up to. Keeps you interested in what they do and what they're about, and that makes you want to read them more, listen to their music more, or buy their product more. So I bring them back. Well, when I do that, my wonderful guest go out and bring more guests to me and say, you got to get on her show. She's a lot of fun. She's entertaining. She's interesting. And you're so at ease with her, so you got to get on her show. So my guest list keeps growing. Right now I am booked through the middle of November with a few open spots here and there. I'm excited because my year is almost booked, and I'm getting ready to start booking for next year. Y'all have been so good to me, both as guest and as a listening audience, that I know you probably get sick of saying I'm so honored, humbled, and proud, but I am, and I'm grateful because this show was a 5-year dream, and y'all have made it real, and for that, I am very, very appreciative. So tell your friends and neighbors, keep listening, and if next year is anything like this year's has been, we will be more than off the chain, ladies and gentlemen. You'll have a whole new genre of books to read and music to listen to, so stay tuned. It's only going to get better from here. And that brings me to my guest tonight. I started studying about this wonderful, wonderful woman, doing my research. Y'all all know that in my other life I was a bounty hunter, so I know how to find things about people. And I can't wait to bring her to you and talk to her because this woman is absolutely amazing. Her name is Ellen Byron, and The Body on the Bayou is her second book in her Cajun Country Mystery series, which recently won the Left Coast Crime Lefty Award for Best Humorous Mystery and is nominated for an Agatha Award in the category of Best Contemporary Novel. Ellen's debut novel in the series, Plantation Shudders, was nominated for Agatha, Lefty, and Daphne Awards and made the USA Today bestseller list. Book 3, A Cajun Christmas Killing, will launch on October the 10th. Ladies and gentlemen, I will be bringing Miss Ellen back in November to talk about A Cajun Christmas Killing. She's told me a little bit about it, and I can't wait to bring her back to launch it for y'all on this show. Ellen has written over 200 national magazine articles, published plays, including, ladies and gentlemen, the award-winning Graceland. Her TV credits include Wings. Now, some of you young ones might not remember that series, Wings. It was hysterical. It was fall down funny. She's also wrote the TV credits for Just Shoot Me, Fairly Odd Parents, and other pilots. So without further ado, let's just get into the meat of this matter and welcome to our show, Ellen Byron. Welcome, my dear. I am so grateful that you came and visited us tonight.
Well, thank you so much for having me. I'm thrilled to be here. And
Go on, sorry. No, go ahead.
I was going to say, I'm afraid we have to make the Agatha Award. That was a past tense because the Amalis Domestic that presents it already passed, and I'm afraid I didn't win, but the person who did win was Louise Penny. So the fact that I'm even in her company, was, and she's the loveliest woman in the world. I've been lucky enough to meet her a couple of times. So mystery fans, she took home the teapot, as I like to say, because that's the prize at Amalis. It's a teapot. So Louise took home the teapot, but it was well deserved. I've read every one of her books, and I'm fangirling all over when it comes to Louise.
But the fact that you were in that company of being nominated.
Oh yes.
What an honor.
It was Barbara Ross and Hank Phillippe Ryan and Katrina McPherson. I mean, just these extraordinary writers, and it was a wonderful experience. And Alice gave me my start, so I have a special fondness for that particular convention. In the mystery world, that is.
There you go.
Yeah.
Well, let's take a step back in your memory pockets and talk about how you got here. When you were a little girl, was mysteries and writing and all things interesting in your wheelhouse, or did you have another?
I think scratch any mystery writer, and they'll have been a Nancy Drew itch. I mean, especially for us gals. I mean, so many of us, read, whether we knew we were going to write mysteries or not, we all were. I was addicted to Nancy Drew as a kid. But I wanted to be an actress. I was going to be a famous actress. Well, how many of us have that dream? So many people. And I did, I graduated high school in 3 years so I could get to college and study drama. And I started SUNY Binghamton. And then transferred to Tulane in the middle of my sophomore year. But anyway, going back, when I was 14, before I started high school, I was doing a summer program in New York, a six-week program at the American Academy of Dramatic Arts. And my parents lived in Westchester County, so I would take the train back and forth to the city. And I needed something to read, so I picked up Agatha Christie and was completely hooked. And I've read every one of her books, and some of them multiple times. And I think by the end of that summer, I pretty much devoured as much Agatha Christie as I could get my hands on. So that started a passion for mysteries, but it was more of a hobby and a reading interest.
Well, when you were studying acting, was there any particular genre that you wanted to act, or was it just acting in general?
It was acting in general, but I fell in love with, even though I'm completely wrong for doing his plays, Tennessee Williams. To me, Tennessee Williams is a poet as well as a playwright. I mean, lines like, "For now the world is lit by lightning." And one of the companion piece to Graceland is called Asleep on the Wind. And the title is based on, is taken from one of his plays, Orpheus Descending, where there's a line about a bird. And he says about this little bird, "It sleeps on the wind and never lights on this earth one time but to die." And it was like, so I took that and turned that into title and got permission from his estate and everything. And so But the irony is, I mean, I ended up really being in comedy. I ended up doing improv and for years as I was getting my writing career started, and that's why I ended up writing mostly for television. But my plays and my book, my mysteries, have a combination of comedy. There are lots of laughs, but there's also heart. And, you know, if I can make – I mean, I've always felt if I can make people laugh and cry in the same area, that's great. And of course, that doesn't happen when you're writing a sitcom, and it's not true of, you know, all my books, but it is, I think, in a couple of my plays I did achieve that.
Well, I'm going to tell you, to have written 200 articles for National Magazine, that's a lot of writing.
Mm. Well, I did mostly, I like to call it entertainment journalism, and I just, what happened is once I started writing plays, and for a while I was trying to act and write plays, and then I just basically segued, you know, I started doing the improv, which fulfilled my need to perform, but I was really, had become a writer, and my dad was in advertising, and both my brothers are writers, so it's really seems to be a gene in our family, and so I got lucky and was able to take from, you know, I started writing. My dad, being in advertising, connected me to one of his magazine clients, and I did a freelance for them. And out of that grew, you know, connections to other magazines like Red Book and Glamour and Mademoiselle and, you know, and all these women's magazines, really. You know, Family Circle, Women's Day. Some of them aren't even around anymore, a lot of
That's
them.
That's true.
But I supported myself either through teaching playwriting or mostly through freelance journalism, freelance magazine writing.
I went
until
to...
Until I got into television.
And I remember Wings. That was one of the funniest sitcoms that I ever watched.
Oh, thank you. I was on it for I write television with a writing partner. So we were on it for the last three seasons it was on, and it was tremendous fun. It was a fantastic cast and fantastic fellow writers, and it was a great experience. I've been lucky. All my TV experiences have been, you know, terrific. I mean, there are a couple that haven't been so terrific, but I won't be talking about those.
We only got to talk. Well, even the ones that weren't so terrific, my philosophy is it was not a failure. It was a learning experience, so you really succeeded.
Exactly, yes. Absolutely. No, it's – and you also learn about yourself. You know, okay,
yeah.
Well, what – I mean, I think to – you know, it's a tough business, and you have to own – you know, well, how do I need to pivot for future jobs? And it's also a business that even to this day, in terms of sitcoms, I think less so for dramas, that has just more men than women doing it. You know, when you're on a staff, it's better now sometimes, but even so, if you look at, you know, comedy showrunners versus drama showrunners, there are way more female drama showrunners than comedy to this day.
That's true.
So,
I read something interesting about. I've read several somethings interesting. Besides all of that, I went on the blog that you do with several of your ladies, and there were two.
Oh, chicksonthecase.com.
Yes.
Yeah.
There were two blogs that caught my eye. The first blog was that your family almost bought the Gatsby House. Tell the audience. About that.
Well, when I was 9 years old, we were living in Queens, New York, which is a borough of New York for those who are from another country. It's a borough of New York City. And the school system in New York at the time in the city was not great. So my parents, what you did then is you don't send, you know, unless you're sending your kids to Catholic school or something, you move to the suburbs of New York where they have good school systems for a lot of suburbs. So my parents started house hunting, and we lived in a part of Queens called Little Neck, which is on the border with Long Island and borders a town called Great Neck. And so, you know, and I guess I went with them. I don't know if I went with them a lot, but I went. I have a very vivid memory of going to this house, and I had such a pic. And I remember the real estate agent saying, well, this is where F. Scott Fitzgerald started to write The Great Gatsby. And I'm 9 years old, and why would I know that or care or remember that or have? What's amazing to me is I have such a vivid picture of that house that when I decided to write the blog about, you know, how we almost bought this house, and it's so strange I remember, and if you think back, and now as an adult, and I recently, last year, I reread a lot of F. Scott Fitzgerald, and he's just like such an amazing writer. And to think that we could have been living and breathing and walking and in the rooms where he envisioned, you know, this book and started to create this book. They rented the house from the years, I think, 1922 to 1924. I mean, part of me is like, oh, I so wish we had bought that house. I mean, it's just that kind of history and a place is just amazing to me. So unfortunately, we didn't buy it.
When I was reading the blog, the first thing that came to my mind was Ellen could take that memory and she could write a beautiful novel using that memory as a setting.
Oh, well, that's a, yeah, that's a great idea.
Of a young child, jot that down. Yeah, seriously, write it down. I said, I'm telling myself I'm going to tell her that because it could be a young girl whose family did buy the house,
mm-hmm.
who gets her inspiration from the house.
Mm-hmm. Oh, very interesting. I'm actually, you hear silence on the end, because actually it gave me an idea for another series, so I'm actually writing something down.
There
so,
you go. See, this happens a lot on this show.
I was
this
like, oh, you just gave me an idea. Oh, I just had a great idea. So, yeah, so.
Yeah,
anyway.
See?
So
ladies,
I just.
This is what
yeah,
happened.
Yeah, listeners, there's a pause, and then if the series comes to fruition, I'll say, this is where it all started.
But when I was reading it, I'm thinking, oh, she should take this and run with it.
Yeah.
Because I see this little girl in my mind wandering
mm-hmm.
through this house and this real estate agent going on
mm-hmm.
and on and on about F. Scott Fitzgerald
mm-hmm.
and living in this house
mm-hmm.
and his inspiration, and this was the room he wrote in
mm-hmm.
and this was the room that he did da-da-da, and this little girl's mind is whirly-gigging like crazy
mm-hmm.
and she starts this book and the inspiration
mm-hmm.
is the house.
Mm. Very
See?
Interesting.
Go with God, my child. I can't wait for you to write it.
Well, I actually, it led me in a slightly different direction, though, too. That,
well, there you
about,
go.
Well, I better keep my ideas to myself. So, but it was definitely inspired by what you're saying.
So there you
so.
Go. Well, now that
yeah, yeah.
also what because of my background, I read the other blog that you wrote about visiting your friend when you were a little girl in this town that you had not made friends. You know
Jess,
where I'm going with this.
I know exactly where you're going because it's where we did buy the house, where my parents did buy a house. That was the house they didn't buy. And then the other blog was about the house they did, not about the house, but in the neighborhood that they did buy. Yes.
Well, that also spurred a storyline. I'm thinking Ellen needs to take this and run with it, especially with something else I'm going to segue into, but tell that story because this is so interesting because I can see your little mind working overtime.
And yeah, well, what happened is, so we did buy a house in a community called Scarsdale, which is a suburb of New York, and we moved there during the Christmas break between my 9th and 10th years, and I didn't, you know, it felt like I might as well have moved to another state or another country. It felt so far away from where I lived and how I lived in Queens, and I was wandering around trying to meet kids, and I finally met a girl. Very nice girl. She was like, I said in the piece I wrote that she was preternaturally sophisticated. There's always something about her that was just unique. And I just remember having a play date at her house, and her dad came home, and she lived in this beautiful Tudor, you know, I mean, the houses in Scarsdale are spectacular. It was like a Tudor mansion, basically. And her dad comes home and says hi, very nice guy. I remember I have a vision of him. He kind of looked like Don Draper from Mad Men. And I saw under his jacket, he had a holster and a gun. And, of course, I'm like 10 at that point. And I'm like, why does this man have a holster and a gun? And it really stayed with me. And, of course, I'm not going to ask. And then shortly after that, they moved. They moved to Dallas. And this has stayed with me. This stayed with me my entire life. Like, why did this man, you know, people guess, oh, he's in law enforcement, whatever. Okay, well, he's living in a big, gorgeous house in Scarsdale, which is a, you know, an internationally famous community for wealthy people, although we weren't. We moved there for schools, for the school system. And so it always stayed with me, and I always, it's been haunting me. So a mutual friend, it turned out that someone I went to, you know, was in elementary school with, I became Facebook friends with her, and I asked her, you know, I messaged her one day, do you remember this girl? I won't mention her name. Yeah, and she goes, yeah, I'm Facebook friends with her. I'm like, really? So I sent the girl I'd been friends with briefly before she moved to Dallas, I sent her a Facebook friend request, and she accepted it. I was like, oh, my God, I may finally get the answer to this question I've had ever since I was 10 years old. And so it took, I waited a couple of months, and but she seemed like one of those people. First of all, she still looked exactly the same. And she'd moved back to New York and was living an incredibly hip life. And so I finally got up the nerve and said, hey, you know, I have this memory from when we were kids, and I just wondered, what did your dad do for a living? And I never heard back. So it's like one of those tantalizing things where it's so close. I'm so close to getting this simple question from my childhood, like a dad's job, answered, and it's not happening. So, and, you know, all my friends are like, you know, at the time, I mean, if I'm still friends with some of those kids, but we were all like 10. So nobody knew what your dads did. So, so it's so frustrating, but I did write a blog post about it, and I gave all the clues and said, you know, people, what do you think he did? You know, and there was a lot of like, you know, oh, he was in the mob, but, you know, I didn't mention this in the blog post, but he was Jewish. And even though my grandfather was Jewish mob, and disappeared, and that's another book I'm eventually going to write. I didn't think it was that, you know. So it's a big mystery. It's like, what did this man do that allowed him to afford a gorgeous house in a wealthy community, moved to Dallas, carried it in, but carried. So that was...
And there's yet another series for you. And you
yes.
just segue into my next question about I read the thing you put out about your grandfather, and I found it so interesting. Again, tell the folks that story, because I can just see this little boy.
Yeah, well, and we don't know if this was, you know, what happened is that my dad. My grandparents, I'm half Italian and half Jewish. My mom was actually born in Italy and came over when she was 3. So growing up, I had these two very different backgrounds. You know, there was like the full-on New York Italian where literally I go to a family function and it was in the basement of a row house in Queens, and there was like a cloud of cigarette smoke hanging above us as the men sat there and what we called wife beaters, but my husband from the Midwest, they call it grandpa, you know, tank tops, undershirts. And no one spoke English. And then my dad was an only child, but we go to his family function, and it was Long Island and Jewish families and Jewish food. And but anyway, when my dad, my grandmother, it was an arranged marriage, and my grandmother's family had been very wealthy, and then they lost the money through family mismanagement and the Depression. And there's actually a theme to that. I'm jumping all over the place. But in the book, my third book, which will be out in October, Cajun Christmas Killing, there's a theme, the son is not the father, and that was inspired by the fact that my grandmother, part of the reason they lost the money was because her brother didn't have the smarts that the father had. But anyway, suppose they lost money, and my grandfather was a low-level Jewish, I'll just go ahead and say it, he's low-level Jewish mob, because I don't know if he was a wannabe, if he was official. He was in jail for embezzlement at one point. He embezzled from Chase Manhattan Bank. Anyway, they had gone up to the Boston area, and supposedly he told my father, left him on the front of the building when my dad was like 6 or 7, and said, you wait here, I'll be back, and I'll take you swimming. And my grandmother got home from wherever she was working. My father was still waiting for him, and no one ever saw him again. And I only recently found out, I was talking to my mom, because I'm really, this has been haunting me my entire life, because my dad never, ever spoke to him. I never, ever heard my father mention a word about his father. And when I was, so it's, you know, and I really want to write about this, and I have different ways to go about it, but not that long ago, I've been trying to do more research. Even when I was younger, I'd ask my relatives, because the only people who would talk about him were the people who married into the family. We tried to get my aunt, his sister, to talk about it, and she was very, no, I don't want to talk about it. But she did say, they said about him, he'd rather earn a dishonest dime than an honest dollar. And my mother recently said, oh, because I'd heard that my grandmother went to look for him, and some associate said, you know, she'd be better off looking in the bottom of the river. And I was mentioning this to my mother. She goes, no, it wasn't an associate. It was a gangster. She went to ask the gangster. And I read a biography not that long ago of Meyer Lansky, and it talked about how he was up in Boston area in the late 20s and early 30s setting up a crew. And I'm like, how many Jewish mobsters would there have been in the late 20s and early 30s in that area? I have to assume my father was somehow involved with, my grandfather was somehow involved with Murder Incorporated and that group. So I am writing about that now. I'm, you know, in the very rough bones of that, and I'm, you know, it's, and so I'm excited because it's, you know, it's hard, but I figured what I can't solve in real life, I will solve in fiction.
There you go.
Yeah.
And I'm as I was reading this, I'm going, oh my goodness, it just goes to prove, ladies and gentlemen, that we all are human, and every family has a story, mine included.
Well, you know, when I teach playwriting, if I teach anything, that's what I teach. I tell the students that they are their own individual treasure chests. Think of yourself as a treasure chest, because all your experience, no one has ever had, there's not one human being on the planet who's had the experiences you've had, or has had, because they're specific to you. Even if it's a general experience, you had your specific experience of it. And so that's what, and you have your own specific reaction to it. And so that's a treasure chest that no one else can steal from, because it's yours.
And you were the only one.
Oh, by the way, every idea I've spoken about here is mine.
Exactly. It is yours. And anybody that tries to steal it, y'all know I will send flying monkeys after you. They are hers. Even the ones I gave her are hers. And all
exactly.
I did was facilitate.
That's funny.
But what you were just saying is they are our own emotions. It's like I try to tell people with my background that I have in my degree, which is criminal justice, if I go out and interview somebody or several somebody that has seen a train wreck, if there's five people standing there, I'm going to get five different stories, five different emotions, and five different feelings.
Mm-hmm.
So even if two people experience climbing up Mount Kilimanjaro, there's going to be two different reactions.
Exactly.
Because like you say, it is exclusive to that person, which makes life so much fun. Now, you wrote the Body on the Bayou. And while you were writing that book, tell our listening audience what was happening in New Orleans.
The floods?
Yes.
Which actually figure into, I'm writing to that in the fourth book in the series that will be out in 2018, which is right now titled Mardi Gras Murder. And a lot of what happens is facilitated by the floods. And so when I went to start, and they happened the day before in Baton Rouge, these are the floods. This is not Hurricane Katrina we're talking about, by the way. These were the floods in Baton Rouge that happened in 2000 and just this past summer, 2016. And a month, the day before I was going to start, you know, doing my promo campaign for the book, the floods hit. So I was like, what do I do? I can't really be like, hey, I wrote this book, Body in the Bayou, when bayous are flooding. And, you know, there were possibly bodies in the bayou.
The bayou,
so,
and probably were.
Yeah, exactly. So, you know, so I actually wrote, what I did is I wrote a blog post about that, about, you know, what you do. And I reached out to the mystery community, and I took some time, and I donated, of course, to the flood relief. And, you know, and so, and specifically, and then to friends, I have very dear friends who were affected, and I donated personally to them to help them out. But, you know, it was it was something. And so now, you know, I like to write to the real of the area, you know, and let that of where I'm, you know, what I'm writing about, and let that inspire me, and sometimes educate people on, like, things they might not know about it. You know, I call myself an unofficial travel ambassador. And people will sometimes contact me through my website and say, hey, I'm thinking about going to New Orleans or going to Louisiana. Any tips? And I'm like, oh, absolutely.
Oh.
And that's why I'm like, you know, in my – let's go on, sorry.
And New Orleans is one of my favorite cities.
Oh, I just – my dream is to live there part of the year someday.
It's a beautiful – ladies and gentlemen, if you've never been to New Orleans, whether Mardi Gras or just to go, it is so alive with electricity and emotion and people and visions and dreams. And
yes.
Give me some more words, Ellen, because there's just no words.
Well, I would, and music, you know, and atmosphere, and I would also say, look at experiencing Jazz Fest once
uh-huh.
in your lifetime. I mean, it's a crazy situation, but I love, it's the New Orleans Jazz and Heritage Festival, and they have, like, what's great is not only are there, like, a ton of tents featuring every kind of music from, like, huge pop stars to, like, down-home Cajun Zydeco bands. There's also, like, amazing food. There are all these food stands. There's a dish called Crawfish Monica that I live for. And then there are these heritage, like, you know, there are people selling things they make. Excuse me. And that's where, actually, the voodoo priestess in my book, Helene Brevel, is inspired by a real woman I met years ago at a jazz fest named Ava K. Jones. And what I loved about her is, you know, I had her make me a gree-gree bag, and I could pay with it. She took credit cards. And so that's why I created a voodoo priestess who you never meet, because she literally has made so much money from, like, making gree-gree bags for the sorority girls at LSU that she's always, that in every book so far, she's been off on an extended cruise through the Caribbean and the world. So, but in book four, if this story that I have, well, no, actually not in book four, but if I get picked up for more books, I have a story that will incorporate her. She will finally be seen. So,
ladies and gentlemen, you're learning so much. This is so exciting. Now, you also wrote something where this reader said she hated your book, and I'm going, really? Because her logic was just so skewed.
She said the humor was inane. This was Body on the Bayou, but it was funny because she said, I found the humor inane, but but then my mother says I don't have a sense of humor. And I don't even remember where that was, like, oh, I think the fellow chicks who were all talking about how, you know, there was one particular reader who seemed to find fault with pretty much each of us. And then in generally we found her somewhere, and she was like, she seemed to find fault with everybody except, like, one certain author. So, you know, we began to think, oh, she's trying to trash us all just to, like, goose the sales of the one author she does like, you know.
That's probably, and that's so sad, because what winds up happening is she only hurts herself, because
yeah.
her credibility is shot.
Exactly. And it's, you know, she was a she's like a troll, I guess. And, you know, I you don't really, honestly, it's like I don't read, I don't have time to read a lot of my reviews, but I need them. So if anyone reads my book, please, please post a review. And don't be insulted if I don't read it. Know that I really, really appreciate it. But, and also it's like, it's A, it's a matter of time, but B, it's also like if I read 10 reviews and one has a, you know, a comment, like a, not a positive comment, I won't remember any of the 10 good things. I'll only remember like, oh, well, they had a, you know, the bad one. So, so I don't, and then I like, then it kind of like, then you start trying to please a complete stranger who you might never, ever be able to please. So I don't want that to color what I write. But that being said, I have readers have, excuse me, gotten in touch with me and said things that have absolutely either that have helped me and that I have completely addressed. I had one reader got in touch and said, I really, really like your book, but I was a little upset because you took the Lord's name in vain and too much. And I'm like, what? Because I realize the genre I write is there's no gratuitous sex, violence, or language, and which is completely fine with me. I'm not that person, but it is the way I write. So for some reason that I've never understood, I'm not comfortable writing the other things. So I'm good, like not writing them. But so I was like, and my publisher and I went over the book very carefully to make sure there was none of that. In fact, a couple of times I had a character who said Jesus or something, and we pulled all those out. So I was like, so I did a search of the book to see how what the woman was talking about, and what I discovered is in my first book, my protagonist Maggie exclaims, "Oh my God!" a couple, you know, whenever she exclaims, and I realized, oh, because I do that, and I gave her that trait, and so I responded. I said to the woman, I said, "Thank you so much for pointing this out. I'm going to be more careful in the future. I think I know what you're talking about," and she was like, oh my gosh, I can't believe you got back to me. I mean, she was like so thrilled that I responded. And yeah, I the next now my character doesn't say that anymore. And you know, you always think it's a challenge. Like one of the first things I learned as a playwright was you only use profanity when you can't think of a better way to say something. And it was like such a great lesson because it taught me to always look for a better way to say something and more it made me more creative. Like, if she's not going to exclaim, oh, my God, I did, honey. Yeah. No worries. That was just my – we were just making sure the dogs are fed. I have two dogs. We have two rescue dogs. So, so and that I like that. And so, in fact, in A Cage in Christmas Killing, the grandmother, grandmère, is upset about something, but she's not a character who would ever use profanity. So I had to come up with, like, you know, instead of saying, you know, I won't say the word, you know, instead of saying the S word, she starts saying, she goes, shiver my timbers, you know, so she's constantly finding a way. And it was so much fun to find, oh, mummy funny, you know, find ways she would, you know, not use, a, you know, use profanity as a jumping off point, but come up with a bend on it. So
that is funny. I can just see Grandma Mary going, oh, shiver me timbers.
Yeah, exactly. So it was really
the
fun to play with that.
And the visual
yeah.
is now stuck in my head.
Oh, that's it. So.
I love it.
Anyway. Yeah,
now,
and actually it was, go on.
Go ahead, Twitter.
Sorry.
No, go ahead.
No, I was saying it was the reader emailing me through my website that reminded me to do that, to be creative.
And see, ladies and gentlemen, we do interact with our readers because if we don't get feedback, we can't become better.
Yes.
And if it's given in the right way without completely ripping us apart, because we are human, ladies and gentlemen, we do have feelings. Believe it or not, we do
mm-hmm.
have feelings.
Mm-hmm.
And if a reader comes at us without ripping us apart, just offering a friendly suggestion, it's taken in kind better than if someone comes at us full bores with their fingernails out because maybe
right.
they had a bad day. I don't know.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
tell the folks why you love writing about New Orleans and the culture, because New Orleans is a culture all to itself.
Well, this is something that the people need to know so they're not disappointed when they read my books, actually, is that I don't write about New Orleans. I'm writing about Cajun, really plantation and Cajun country. Although in A Cajun Christmas Killing, they finally, Maggie and Beau finally, the protagonists, do actually go to New Orleans. So I did finally get to write about New Orleans. And that was so much fun because I wrote about, I wrote it right after we'd been there. And so I got to like, you know, and we went there for Christmas 2 years ago. And so I got to really be there about the time when I was writing it about. And so, you know, I fell in love with South Louisiana when I was a student at Tulane University, which is in New Orleans. And I, you know, my parents came to visit a couple of times because they were like, yay, you're going to school in New Orleans. We're going to see you. We're not that they, you know, care about seeing me. It's like, we get to go to New Orleans. I mean, of course they cared about seeing me. But I went with them a couple of trips out when we drove, you know, into, you know, Cajun country. There's coastal Cajun and prairie Cajun. And we generally head into coastal, although I've since been all, you know, been through all different parts of it. And I just was like fascinated. I was fascinated by the plantations, the, you know, the good and the bad of them. And what's very interesting is that now, you know, I've done a few plantation tours in the last couple of years, and they very much talk, you know, speak to the to, you know, slavery and they'll show you, you know, they're very some of them, not all of them, but some of the tours are extremely upfront about that, and will even, you know, take you to slave cabins. But I just the energy, the food, what I really love is in terms of Cajun country and the Cajun culture, and of course there's also Creole, and so Maggie's ancestors are Creole as well, which is like first born in this country, but it's like of a very European background. What I love and what connected to my personal life is that there is a section of this country where people have been here for over 250 years that had its own language. And that you still hear. When we were there at Christmas 2015, we went to this little restaurant on River Road called B&C Seafood, and it's this little old place that's popular among locals. You know, you have to kind of know it. And there's a table of people sitting there laughing and talking, and they were speaking French. And they were, you know, not like senior citizens. I mean, I think it's, you know, there had to be a concerted effort to keep it alive. But the reason I think that connected to me was because of my background on the Italian side, that, you know, growing up with in a culture within a culture, that I would go, you know, I had lived my American life, but I go to family functions. It was like being in another country with another language. And so that, I think, was my emotional connection to it. But just the people are so warm. You know, there's just a warmth and a joie de vivre. I mean, the motto of New Orleans and Louisiana in general, and specifically southern Louisiana, is laissez le bon temps rouler, which means let the good times roll.
Yep.
And, you know, and that is how life is lived. And in fact, a friend who is a lawyer said once, well, you know, the reason Atlanta surpassed New Orleans as the most, you know, cosmopolitan and biggest and, you know, the center of the South was because really no one in New Orleans wants to work that hard. It's like, you know, they want to knock off its, and this is a generalization, of course, and other people from New Orleans will go, what? But, you know, they know they want to live life. They want to leave at, you know, 6 or 7 or whatever and go have a drink and go eat and go to a festival. And, you know, and 80%, I learned that 80% of Louisiana citizens are native born. And I think it's the highest percentage. It's one of the highest percentages in the country. I mean, you know, if you go to the far western states like Montana and the Dakotas and stuff, you probably have a huge percentage of native-born, too. But yeah, people just, you know, they're proud of them.
And like you and like me, unless you have gone there and experienced the culture, what we're saying people cannot fully appreciate because
yeah. –
It's not something that, unless you've been there, you don't get it.
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, I always encourage people, it's like, yes, definitely go to New Orleans and spend a couple of days in New Orleans, but then leave and go out and rent a car and drive, you know, within, I mean, Lafayette, which is the center of, you know, the heart of Cajun country, is only 3 hours from New Orleans. But you can get to, like, a little town, you know, off the River Road, off the Mississippi in an hour and a half or an hour even. I mean, the plantations that inspired, you know, the places in my books are 45 minutes from New Orleans. I mean, they're a day trip away. So, you know, and it's more, originally the series was called Plantations and Pralines, and my publisher, I think, was concerned about the plantations angle because it's, you know, it's a love-hate thing. And so we changed it, and I was like, well, Cajun country, because, you know, some maps it's part of it, some maps it isn't, but it still is. And it was also inspired by a friend, Gaynell Bourgeois Moore, who I write about in the, I named a character after her. I met her when she was leading tours of a plantation that's no longer open to the public called Ashland Belle Helene, and that was in the mid-1980s, and we've been friends ever since. And she's, you know, she's 15 years older than me, but she's 100% Cajun, and she sings, and she's an artist. I mean, she's like an amazing, oh, she writes, she's just this amazing woman. And, you know, and she really was inspired me to, you know, really research and become connected to that part of the world. That and my background at college.
That part of the world is steeped in mystique and more than one culture. And this is what a lot of people also don't understand.
Yes.
You have more than one culture. And especially in the southern part, you have the French, you have the slave trade, you have who else? The Spanish.
Well, you have the German. Actually, you have the German coast. The Germans came over before. They were there before the Cajuns even. And
that's
true. And so that's why there are a lot of German names that are go back 300 years in you know Louisiana.
Right.
Wagaspak and Schexnader, or Schexnider, depending how who's pronouncing it. And I think it gets pronounced even differently than that, Schnixner. I mean, people pronounce it all different ways. And so, yeah, there was someone, and I don't have the details of it, but a man brought over a bunch of people from Germany, and then, like, he was basically a scoundrel and then disappeared and just left them there. And then they, well, we can't go. We got to figure out how to live here. So you have, I mean, there's a lovely woman I met through the work, through the series and my, you know, who's works for the River Parishes Tourist Commission, and she's African-American, but she's a huge mix. She's African-American, she's Creole, she's French, she's even got, I mean, it's just this, you know, any one particular citizen there can be a melting pot, like just in one person.
And we see, and we think of New York being this huge melting pot of different cultures, and people mm-hmm. don't realize just how big of a melting pot Louisiana is.
Yes, yeah.
And the rich.
And by the way,
history,
I'm not. I have to be honest and say I'm not familiar with Northern Louisiana at all. So I've never. I don't even, you know, I have been north of I-10, but barely. So,
uh-huh. But it,
so,
it's like,
you know,
daylight and dark because you've got southern Louisiana, which has its own rich
yeah
history and background and culture, and then northern Louisiana, which I've not been north of Louisiana, of like you, of I-10, but I'm kind of thinking
yeah.
it's more geared toward the Midwestern environment. I could be wrong.
Yeah, I don't really know. I honestly, I think you're right to some extent. I mean, even the topography is different there. It's more
mm-hmm.
it's hillier. I mean, it's not flat like South Louisiana is. So you know, but I mean, I wish I knew more about it, and I'm sorry I don't. But it's more. I think it's more either southern or tipping a little more west, but it's more like general Southern, I would say. And, but again, I don't want to. I can't really speak to it because I don't know it. So I wouldn't want anyone from Alexandria, Monroe, or Shreveport to get on, you know, to get on my case.
Well, and then when you go into the bayous, in Southern Louisiana, that's even a different culture altogether.
Well, it's still Cajun, you know, in the bayous. I mean, it's still, and it is a mix. I mean, it's all, you know, there are people who are pure Cajun, and then there's a, you know, a polyglot, a big mix. But it's, I would say that's kind of part of parcel of what, you know, I'm talking about in the area.
But it's such a wonderful, ladies and gentlemen, if you haven't gone, you need to go. And it's like Ellen said, take day trips. Go and visit things outside of the city. I have a really good friend who lives in Baton Rouge. And she's a nurse at the hospital there. And it's like you say, get off work and let's go party. They love to party, eat, drink, and be merry and let the good times roll.
Well, I was I appeared at the Louisiana Book Festival last year, which is in Baton Rouge, and I'm going back this year because I loved it so much. And I pay for it myself. You know, I get myself there, I house myself, and I spent a night in Baton Rouge, and then I went down and spent my friend came with me, and then we went to her place, and I spent the night with her and at her place, and then we just went into the quarter for, you know, it was the weekend before Halloween, so it was like the best time to be in. You know, it's a great time to be there. But yeah, I mean, it's, you know, it's all so rich. I was going to say something I said before, talking about coastal and prairie Cajun. I mean, I saw a book recently that broke it up into lower prairie and upper prairie, but, to me, in my head, it's really, and some others, it's like coast, you also see it as like coastal and prairie, and prairie terms tends to be more north of I-10, and then kind of clinging to the rim of it on the south side, and coastal, of course, is down, you know, south of I-10, which is like near Lafayette and the bayous and that whole area, and it's actually, the difference is actually reflected even in the food. Like, you'll have, of course, there's more seafood, oriented dishes in coastal, and more meat oriented because they're prairie, you know, there are ranges and the boucherie where the, you know, the pig carvings and so, I don't know how to describe that, you know, but you know, and also there's a difference between Cajun and Creole jambalaya, and which is, you know, Creole jambalaya is made with tomatoes, so it's red. And Cajun isn't, so it's browner. And you know, so just little things.
Well, we will continue this discussion when I bring you back in November, because believe it or not, we're going to run out of time.
Oh, okay.
The hour is just about gone, and I don't want us to run completely out of time before you tell everybody where you can be found.
I can be found at ellenbyron.com, and it's ELLEN, B as in boy, YRON, .com. Sometimes people mix it up. I also have an author page on Facebook, author page, and I also blog with a multi-author blog that's called chicksonthecase.com. And it's six of us gals, and it's really, it's fun. We keep the posts very light. And we have individual posts, and we also have a group post on Fridays. So, and that's a fun thing. And also Twitter. I'm on Twitter. It's at Ellen Byron LA. But because there's an Ellen Byron New York, believe it or not, who writes for the Wall Street Journal. So,
oh my goodness.
So not infrequently get like, hey, I read your article. I'm like, no, that wasn't me. And it's like, hey, I've got a great product. Can you write about it for the journal? And I'm like, no. In fact, on LinkedIn, I have a header saying, I am not that Ellen Byron. Do not try to sell me a product. I cannot get you into the Wall Street Journal. So,
real quick, tell the folks the books that are out.
Plantation Shutters is out, and it's out in paperback, Kindle, hardback, audio, Audible. Body on the Bayou is out. It will be out. It's out on everything. Paperback will launch on September 10th. There'll be a trade paperback version of that out then, but it's available in the other forms now. And then October 10th, Cajun Christmas Killing launches in Kindle, hardcover, and audio forms.
And ladies and gentlemen, we're going to bring Ellen back after I get off from here. I'm going to send her some dates. We're going to bring her back in November, and we're going to have our own launch party for a Cajun Christmas Killing. So
yes,
we will have fun.
We will launch
and then
on this series.
Yes, and then we'll bring her back next year for the new book that'll be out next year. So, yes, Ellen will be one of our regular guests, and we can continue our discussions about the wonderful city known as NOLA. And for those of y'all who don't know what
exactly
that means, it's New Orleans. And it's not New Orleans, it's New Orleans. Right, Ellen?
That's right. New Orleans.
Exactly.
And NOLA is it stands for N-O, New Orleans, Louisiana, L-A, N-O-L-A.
There you go. ladies and gentlemen, Monday night I will have a special show with film director, producer, Jennifer Dawn with Forbidden Tears Productions. She has just finished doing a film called Passageway to Hell, and we are going to be talking about that. She called me up and said, Yvonne, please, can I get on your show? And I said, I'm booked, but because it's you. So we're doing a special show with her on Monday night at 8 o'clock Eastern Daylight Time. Wednesday night, author Sherry Rentzler will be here with us at 8 o'clock Eastern Daylight Time. And then I will be in Cocoa Beach from Thursday to Sunday at Space Coast Lovers Book Event. I will be signing books, shaking babies, and kissing hands, and whatever else. It's a four-day event, so y'all need to join us if you are up there near Cocoa Beach. We'll be at the International Palms Conference Center and Resort. And then the next week we'll start all over, and yes, Miss Ellen will come back. Now, ladies and gentlemen, y'all all know, every one of you know, y'all have been with me long enough, you know that I always end the show with this, and that is, if you are a dreamer, if you know someone who is a dreamer, do not allow anyone to steal those dreams. And if you have a child, or you know a child that is a dreamer, and that child comes to you and says, I am going to be the next president of the United States, please, whatever you do, do not do this. You're not smart enough. Or don't think you can do that. Do not do that to them, because that will destroy a child's little dream. And that is not a little dream. That is a big dream. You encourage that child. While that child may decide that they don't want to be president, that's fine. But they have set their path. So you encourage that child. And if someone comes to you and says, I'm going to write a book, or I'm going to write music, or I'm going to do this, don't discourage them. Encourage them. Because the reason is, like Ellen and myself, and astronauts and presidents and inventors, we are dreamers. And the reason we are dreamers is because we have a vision. Am I right, Miss Ellen?
Oh, absolutely.
So, yes, you too can be dreamers, but you got to make it happen. And don't discourage yourself, and don't let anyone else discourage you. Ellen, thank you so much, my dear, for being with me tonight, and I cannot wait to have you come back with me. And I'm going to leave the audience with these couple of little things that I always like to leave, and that is, don't just feel special, be special. And if you want to achieve success, stop asking permission. And my last one, your smile is your logo, your personality is your business card, and how you leave others feeling after having an experience with you, ladies and gentlemen, that becomes your trademark. And Ellen, I hope that I have left you with a wonderful, wonderful hour, because you have made my hour just, I can't explain it. I've had so much fun.
Well, it's been fantastic. I've really enjoyed it. And thank you so much for this great opportunity. And I'm really, thank you.
You're welcome, and I can't wait for you to come back in November. I'm excited.
I'm looking forward to it. Yes, me too.
So, ladies and gentlemen, remember Monday night at 8 o'clock Eastern Daylight Time, Jennifer Dawn will be talking to us about her new film and when it will be released. We are all excited about that because my friend Barbara Watkins wrote the book that the film is taken from. Wednesday night at 8 o'clock Eastern Daylight Time, author Sherry Rentzler will be with us. She will also be with me up in Cocoa. So if you're a fan of Sherry's, find your way to Cocoa. And just love each other, be kind to each other, and know that tomorrow will rise. This is your host, Yvonne Mason, with my guest, Ellen Byron. And we are off the chain, and we say good night.
Good night.
Thank you, Ellen, again so much. And as soon as this thing goes up, my friend, I will tag you in it when I put it up.
Tag you in the podcast. You did a great job. I mean, you really just, you know, you're a great interviewer.
Well, thank you. You were the second person this week that has said that to me. You don't know how wonderful that makes me feel.
I realized afterwards, launch date for the book, I mean, I hope that wasn't for the third book coming out. I hope that wasn't a problem. Didn't step on the launch.
No.
Oh, good. Okay.
No, honey. We're off the chain. Anything goes.
Oh, good. Great.
No, all is well. As soon as I get out from here, I will send you some dates, and we'll get that set up, and then send you some keep me, if you will, keep me up to date on when you're going to launch the one next year so we can do a show either right after right after it's released or right before so we can launch it for your new fans, your new 20,000 fans on this show.
Oh, I hope.
it's coming, honey. I'm telling you. Things happen to my guests after they've been on this show.
Oh, I hope so. Thank you. I really appreciate that. All right, well, this is great. Thank you so much, Yvonne. And, I'll look for those dates, and I'll let you go.
All right, darling.
Okay, take care.
Take care.
Bye.
Bye-bye.